Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths, the program that is devoted to the largest segment of society. To those of you who have come to realize, as have I, as has Scott, we're glad to have Scott back today, probably with a full mouthful of teeth even today, after his oral surgery yesterday, that recognize that all of the world's religious, political, economic, and military institutions are corrupt, that they are counterproductive. I am Yada. Our number, if you'd like to join us anytime over the next 2 hours, and we'd encourage your call, even if you disagree with us, especially if you disagree with us. 877-376-45. Now, we were talking about a story that I'm going to begin at the beginning, and we'll move through the misconceptions here that were written by the journalist from the Washington Post, and then get to the completion of the article. It began at Bethlehem, West Bank. Are you familiar with a country known as the West Bank, Scott?
I didn't know it was an actual country, but I am familiar with the West Bank.
Yeah, but you've never... West Bank's not a country, is it?
Yeah, I know. No.
No. Yeah, this would be not even a state. I mean, this is not Los Angeles, California. This is not Minneapolis, Minnesota. Bethlehem, West Bank. West Bank is not a country. It's not a state. It's not a province.
It's just a place,
in fact,
right?
It's the West Bank of the Jordan River is what they're referring to. But Bethlehem, to call it the West Bank of the Jordan River, you know, the Jordan River is a long way from Bethlehem. Bethlehem is just south of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is probably 3,000 feet above the Jordan River. You know, to call Jerusalem, for example, as part of the West Bank, or Bethlehem, which is southwest of Jerusalem, the West Bank, then what you're dealing with is a political myth, not with an actual place. So the West Bank of the Jordan River would be like Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were. That'd be the West Bank of the Jordan River. Bethlehem. You're kidding me. And, you know, Beth means the home, family, and Lehem is a bread in Hebrew. So it's the place where the unleavened loaf was served up for humankind, being the diminished manifestation of Yahweh. But it is Bethlehem, Israel. And I'm certain it's Bethlehem, Israel, because Yahweh told us it was Bethlehem, Israel, and He owns the trust deed. You know, when you look for countries, there are not a lot of countries that you can actually have a trust deed for. You know, people have individual property and they have a trust deed for the property. But to have a trust deed for a country, yeah, that's pretty unusual. But here we actually have a copy of the trust deed. And what the trust deed is, it's interesting, is that the owner of the property, which in this case isn't somebody that bought it, he actually created it. Which gives you even, you know, more say as to its use. He and his trust deed on the property specifically gave it to a group of people for their occupancy. And so here on this trust deed for Bethlehem, Israel, we have the creator of the universe, and of that would include our planet, and therefore it would include the land masses on our planet, and therefore it would include the area known as Yisrael, which he has designated. He drew the lines. He said, this is Israel. And he drew then every province of Israel. And Bethlehem is right there in the center of what is Israel. I think that he's entitled to say, this is mine. And I'm going to allow and provide for my people to live here. And so to write Bethlehem West Bank as opposed to Bethlehem Israel, when it's God himself who provided the trust deed and determined who would inhabit his land, to deny that and pretend that the West Bank is a state or a province or a country, it's just worse than ignorance. It's man acting arrogantly, as if political correctness can promote lies and have man's political lies take precedence over Yahweh's eternal truth. I'm just guessing here, but I don't think Yahweh takes very kindly to this. So anyway, this is Bethlehem, the West Bank, and on Monday, Maysoon Musa. Well, the lady's last name was Musa. Is anything that strikes your fancy about Musa? Have you heard of anybody that was named something like Musa? Scott?
Not that immediately jumps to mind.
How about Moses?
Moses, yeah.
Hey, how about in Moses, Hebrew? His name is Moshe, yeah. So, Moshe, Musa? Yeah, it's Arabic it's an Arabic transliteration of Moshe, the one who draws out, the one that Yahweh asked to free and liberate his people. The Quran claims, and because Muhammad claimed, that Moshe was a Muslim prophet. Did you know that?
Did I? No.
Did Moshe identify the name of the God for whom he spoke?
Yeah.
A
few thousand times, yeah.
In fact, the God who spoke to Moshe, didn't he introduce himself by name?
Yep.
Do you recall what he told Moshe was his name?
Yahweh?
That would be it, yeah. Did he, when he introduced himself to Moshe and he said, "My name is Yahweh," did he also add something to it where he said, "That is my one and only name, that is the only name I want to be recalled and mentioned by for all time?"
Yeah.
You're going with yes. That's your final answer?
He threw out another, Elohim and stuff like that. But, yeah, no.
But Elohim's not a name, is it?
Yeah, no, that's more of a title.
A title. Yep. It's a title, yeah. Yeah, he says that his only name is Yahweh, El and Eloah, and Elohim, the plural of Eloah, means mighty ones, almighties. It's a title. It's like Ab, father. El and Ab are both titles. My sons, they refer to me as dad, as father. Is my name dad?
No.
No, when you send me an email or you call me on the phone and you say, this is Scott calling, and you use my name, do you call me dad or father?
I don't think I ever actually say this. Yeah. Scott calling because
I recognize your voice. Yeah, I recognize your voice. But you say hi, Craig, right?
Yep, definitely.
Yep. Because dad is my my title, and it's a title that that's only two people in the world can use appropriately. Well, father is a title that Yahweh has chosen for himself that there's a few thousand people that can use. Covenant children. So you can call Yahweh dad, no problem. You can call Yahweh God if you want to, but he'd prefer you use his name. And so to pretend that Moshe was speaking for Allah means that you have to be completely and totally ignorant of what Moshe revealed that Yahweh had said to him. So you have to be completely ignorant of the Torah to buy into the Islamic myth that is essential to Islam, that Moshe spoke for Allah. Does Yahweh ever refer to himself as Allah?
Never.
What does Yahweh say about a God by another name?
Hate them? They don't exist?
Yeah, they don't exist. That a God by any other name than Yahweh is a false God. So Allah would be a false god, wouldn't he?
Definitely.
According to Moshe, according to Yahweh. And, of course, the Quran also claims its credibility by saying that it confirms the Torah, and yet you've heard us cite the Quran. Every word of the Quran is the antithesis of the Torah.
Very nice.
So you have to be misled. You have to be indoctrinated. You have to be unthinking. You have to be poorly informed. Uninformed might be a better term, to have a last name Musa if you're a Muslim. But anyway, this woman does. She's 19 years old. Her name is Maysoon Musa. She rose early for morning prayers. I asked John yesterday, Scott, how many times that Yahweh, through Moshe and his Torah, asked us to pray. His guess was 26 times. Would you like to fashion a guess as to how many times Yahweh, in the totality of his Torah, asks us to pray?
Zero.
That's your final answer?
That's my final answer.
Well, John was 26 off. You would be precisely accurate. Zero. Does Yahweh, however, encourage us to shama, listen to him, and shamar, observe what he has to say, paying close attention what he has written on our behalf?
Definitely.
Hundreds of times, right?
Hundreds of times, yes. Over and over.
Okay. You have a son. When your son is in need of advice, now your son's a lot younger than you are, a lot less experienced than you are, and when your son is, you recognize your son is in need of some guidance. Do you encourage your son to yabber about what he wants and needs first, or do you instead say, you know, son, I have some experience with this, and I can provide you with some guidance if you're willing to listen to me and consider what I have to say that might be helpful here, and you encourage him to listen to your explanation and guidance and then respond. Would that be the way you go about it? Or do you say, why don't you tell me your experience in this regard, and why don't you provide me with some guidance, Neil, so that because I know you have so much better understanding about these things than I do. Which way do you go about it?
Usually I go the first way, where I give him my experience with it. But yeah, that's what I would do, yeah.
Yeah, you provide your experience. So that's why Yahweh says, you know, I have some experience with these things. But the stuff that really matters with life, particularly eternal life, with the means to being perfected, with the means to being adopted into my family, with the means to being enriched and empowered, with the means to enjoy a quality relationship together, with the means to inherit all that I have to give.
Cool.
To provide you with an owner's manual as to how best to live your life, do you think Yahweh has something to say that might be useful?
Well, do you go into a painter's studio and tell him how to paint?
No. No, you know, I think it's better to listen to what they have to say. They're the experts. Yahweh is the expert. He is here to serve up information and guidance to us that is really useful. It's a good idea that we listen to him first. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. So here we have a list of myths. Bethlehem, which is a accurate Hebrew word, home or house of bread. West Bank, which is wholly and completely inappropriate, is Bethlehem, Israel, more correctly, Yisrael. And if for a Muslim to have a last name of Musa only expresses the Muslim's complete ignorance. The next part was that she rose early for morning prayers. If you're praying and you're doing something that is routine, like a morning prayer, and that is something that is part of your religious routine, you are as far away from God as you could possibly be. Somebody who is praying to God does not know God. God never asks us to pray to him, ever. The word for prayer in Hebrew is used 5 times in the entirety of the Torah, and it's never in Yahweh's voice. It is never something that Yahweh says that he wants us to do. And yet, hundreds upon hundreds of times, he asks us to listen to him and to closely examine and carefully consider what he has communicated in writing to us regarding guidance for living. And then once we've come to know who he is and understand what he is offering through this Torah guidance, then we're in a position to respond to him. He wants to have a conversation with his children, just as all parents enjoy talking with their children. But not until we have come to know who he is, we've accepted who he is, we respect who he is, and that we've come to know, respect, and act upon the 5 terms and conditions that are associated with the covenant, that enable us to be part of his family. So this girl, 19-year-old as a university student, went then to the checkpoints called Checkpoint 300 in Bethlehem. This says, depressing turnstile, and so the author is calling it a depressing turnstile through the high gray concrete wall that separates the Palestinian territory from the West Bank, in the West Bank from Israel. So this person is calling a people Palestinian and saying that there is a Palestinian territory. Scott, are there any Palestinians alive today?
In actuality or fake?
No, in real. Is there a single Philistine survived?
No.
No, there are no Philistines. And has any part of the Philistine culture survived?
No, not that I know of.
No. Do we have anything as an archive or an artifact that the Philistines wrote? Did the Philistines have a language?
No.
No, not a thing. Not a thing that they wrote, not a thing that they achieved. The only thing that is known about the Philistines is told to us by Yahweh. And we learn not only from Yahweh, but from those who would conquer the territory that is known today as Gaza, that the Philistines were completely obliterated around 500 BCE. They were first obliterated by the Assyrians. The Assyrians obliterated much of the northern kingdom of Israel, but they took many of the Jews into slavery, and they stayed distinct as a people and returned. But the Philistines in Gaza, who were so belligerent and so warlike, the Assyrians made no attempt to bring into their culture as slaves. They just killed them. And subsequently, when we hear about Alexander the Great, some 200 years later, going through that area on the way to Egypt, there was a Egyptian outpost that he pummeled on his way into to Egypt. But there were no, he went right through this territory. There were no Philistines to conquer, no Philistines to plunder, no Philistines to engage with. Historians, of course, are prolific in terms of who they met and what they did with those that they met. And, of course, Tyre, which was a Phoenician community, they go to great lengths to show how ruthless and how engaged Alexander the Great was in destroying Tyre, which wouldn't submit to him, in Phoenicia. And then going further south, not a single mention of a people named the Philistines, but there were Egyptian military outposts that he encountered along the way. So we know from history that between 500 and 300 BCE, that the Philistines were wiped off the face of the earth. There were none of them. So that brings us to today, where to call something a Palestinian territory and to refer to people as Palestinians based upon the fact that the Philistines were completely eradicated. There is nothing that is known about them apart from the Torah, and there's no archaeological history that they even existed. It's a myth. There is no such thing as a Palestinian. There has never been a Palestinian. There has been a Philistine, but there haven't been any Philistines for over 2,500 years. And history is absolutely clear that they were obliterated, and therefore there can be no person who identifies with the Philistines and that they no longer exist. And therefore there is no territory known as Palestinian territory. And to provide the myth, the misnomer, that there is such thing as a Palestinian territory, and it exists in a place called the West Bank, and that is isolated and separated from Israel, which is what this says, is three successive lies. So this concrete wall that separates the Palestinian territory, lie one, in the West Bank, lie two, from Israel, lie three. Now, what's interesting is the author wants, because it's politically correct, to make the terrorists appear oppressed and to justify their grievous behavior and to make Israelis look mean and as occupiers. So they are presenting the wall as a depressing turnstile through a gray concrete, high gray concrete wall that separates, because that's politically correct to create that kind of illusion. But the fact of the matter is, if you want to see depressing, drive through the Muslim areas of Bethlehem, which is 99% of Bethlehem today. Try through them, I have. You want to see depressing. Every store is shuttered. The men that are engaged are either sitting there idly, waiting for their next handout from some international source like the United States that provides them with the only money that they receive as gifts which is all they ever survive on because they don't work, or they're younger Muslim men walking around with guns, preparing to be jihadists. That's all you ever see. It is incredibly depressing. There's no life. If ever a place was depressing, that's the place. Now, the reason that Israel has the high wall is because Muslims have made a practice, a great habit, of being terrorists. And so it is to preclude, at least to diminish, the onslaught of terrorism that is perpetrated against the Israelis. It's a good thing they have it. Since they have erected this wall, separating themselves from the Muslim terrorists, there have been far fewer incidents of terror. But this woman, this Muslim woman, got across the wall. She got through the checkpoint. And immediately upon entering Israel, at least from the politically correct point of view, she was in Israel in the West Bank, but she was no longer in the Muslim-controlled areas, and she entered what is known to the world as Israel. She pulled out a curved dagger, one of the most telling signs of Islam, its scimitar, a curved dagger from her back, and she immediately stabbed an Israeli woman in the neck. She tried to do as the Quran orders, to smite her on her neck, which would be to decapitate her. It is disgusting. The victim was a Liron Israeli. She was 19 years old. The assault, a few miles south of Jerusalem's old city, Bethlehem is a part of the suburbs of Jerusalem, was one of seven major attacks in the past 2 weeks alone. The first attack against Israelis occurred on June 19th near a popular spring that's west of Ramallah. Now, Ramallah is an area that is essentially 100% Islamic. It's part of the area that is depressed and lifeless because it is controlled by the mythical institution known as the Palestinian Authority. There, a Muslim, this is an Arab assailant. Now, it is true that there are Arabs there. But what's relevant isn't the fact that there are Arabs there. And it is true also that all of the people who call themselves by the mythical title Palestinian are Arabs. All of them. So if you're looking for a race, the race would be Arab. But Arab is only important in the sense that the Quran and Islam try to associate Arab and Islam together as if they were one, as if all Arabs are Muslim. Now, all Arabs are not Muslim, but the vast majority are. And most Muslims, however, are not Arabs. But to create this myth that to criticize Islam is bigoted and racist, Muslims try to associate their religion with the race. Well, my issue is not with Arab. I don't care what race someone is. You could be any race, and it is irrelevant to me. Your skin color and your nationality are irrelevant. If you want to have a conversation about the fact that I'm a blend of Irish and Sioux Indian, and I'm happy to talk about my heritage, and I'm happy to talk to somebody else about their heritage, and maybe there are some things that are germane to our heritage, but the issue here has nothing to do with the individual being Arab. The issue is the religion of Islam. And Arabic and Arab are only relevant to the extent that Muslims dominate the Arab race with their religion. So this says that an Arab individual, and should say a Muslim assailant, fatally shot an Israeli hiker and then escaped. Didn't shoot somebody that could shoot back. Didn't wear a uniform and say, let's go to war and I want to engage in a military operation, mano a mano, military to military. No. This is the Islamic way. It's the Muhammad's way. He had his goons consistently attack, rob, plunder, rape defenseless civilians. This was a hiker, an Israeli hiker, who was fatally shot by the armed assailant, and the hiker was unarmed. It's what Islam does. 2 days later, this is a Palestinian. Well, we know there is no such thing. They're Philistines ceased to exist 2,500 years ago. It should say a Muslim stabbed a border police officer at the Damascus Gate outside of the old city. The attacker was shot and wounded. I've been through that gate. The Damascus Gate, to me, is interesting because it is 77 paces from the Damascus Gate to the encampment that is known as Golgotha. It is the encampment that is a cliffside that was cut away to create the stone that was used, the limestone that was used to form the Temple Mount. And so what you have is that Mount Moriah, the highest peak of Mount Moriah still exists. It's where the empty tomb is. And immediately beside the empty tomb of Mount Moriah, the highest point of Mount Moriah, which still exists, this encampment was cut for the purpose of establishing the Temple Mount. And so it is right beside the Temple Mount. And it is the bottom of the encampment that is Golgotha, which is the place of the skull. You can still see the outline of what is, you know, looks like a human skull that is carved in gargantuan scale on this encampment. And it's the back, it's right now, the bottom of it is asphalted. It's the back of the Jerusalem bus station. And so I walked through that gate, and I walked to this place. And so where this Israeli was stabbed by the Muslim attacker is a place that I know quite well. It is an extraordinarily interesting place to stand because of what occurred there. In fact, it is against that encampment of Golgotha that Yahusha became the Passover lamb. And directly below the bus station is where the Ark of the Covenant can be found in what's called Yirmiyah's grotto. It's where Ron Wyatt found it and encountered the Moloch. Well, a few days passed, and then at a checkpoint in the Jordan Valley, this is a Palestinian. Well, we're going to just continue with the lies, I guess. Political correctness is a strange beast. It is correct to be incorrect. And, you know, the lie is promoted, and the truth is denied. That's the nature of political correctness. Anyway, this says a Palestinian, a Muslim, opened fire with a handgun at Israelis. He was shot dead. In this particular case, the people that he shot were armed. They were Israeli soldiers. And it didn't prevail. In fact, almost universally, when Muslims encounter an actual armed force, when they encounter those who are prepared to defend themselves, they fail. Israelis are especially anxious about whether the attacks are the work of organized cells directed by armed factions, such as the Islamist group Hamas, which controls the Gaza Strip and is present in the West Bank, or if the violence is being driven by lone wolf perpetrators who strike out for personal or political reasons, or both. Think of the ignorance there. Do you think, Scott, there's one chance in a billion that any of these four murderers and attempted murderers were lone wolves, or were they part of the second largest religion on the earth today? Well, Scott is. What do you think? Could you be called a lone wolf if you're part of a group of people that's 1.5 billion strong?
You cannot be.
No. Now, what do you think was the likelihood of these four people, one murdering an Israeli hiker, one murdering a woman that was just standing by a turnstile, in fact, there's others that I forgot to mention the story, I must have skipped over it, where the Muslim shot a rifle into a car carrying three Israeli youths that had just come back from playing basketball. So the attacker didn't know any of the victims. Do you think that these are random? Do you think there's a political tie? Or maybe is the tie religious? So here's the moron that is the author of this article. That is just filled with misconceptions, myths, and lies, saying that they did not know if the violence was being driven by lone wolf perpetrators. I mean, here's four assaults. All four assaults were perpetrated by Muslims. All four assaults were targeted against Israelis. And all four assaults, the victim and assailant did not know each other. And so to say that someone is a lone wolf when they're acting on behalf of Muhammad and Islam and Allah makes that a myth of gargantuan perspectives, and yet it is discussed and postured as a viable alternative here, the first alternative, by the purveyors of political correctness. And yet it's an absolute anathema. I mean, there's zero possibility that someone who is driven by the second most popular religion in the world could be a lone wolf. The next is, or were they striking out for personal or political reasons? And the answer is neither. It's obvious. They were all Muslims. The Quran orders Muslims to lay in wait and to smite, to kill, to harass, to terrorize. And they're doing exactly what the Quran orders. And in every case, you can be certain that the Muslims shouted, Allahu Akbar, confessing to the crime. So it is a great sadness that we continue to be misled by the media. Turning to Syria, the Syrian military, we're told, carried out a series of airstrikes after what they say rebel forces launched a major assault to take control of the northern city of Aleppo. Aleppo and that area of homes in northwestern Syria is the remaining stronghold of al-Nusra. There are some indications that al-Nusra and the Islamic State are cooperating now on this territory, but it's a territory where the al-Nusra has been in control. Al-Nusra was the original Islamic fundamentalist jihadi group that America armed. It was the dominant Islamic force representing Sunni Islam in the Great Jihad against Assad. When Senator John McClown spoke of arming the Syrian freedom fighters, the people he was arming and wanting to train were al-Nusra. They're fundamentalist Muslims. Al-Nusra has even announced their affinity for al-Qaeda. And so they remain active in the northwestern region, which has been destroyed. If you look at pictures of Aleppo or Homs, it is nothing but a twisted heap of ruins. It's as close to a death zone as you could have on the planet. So the Syrian military, whom America is bombing on behalf of because their most vital opponents of the Assad regime, America has been attacking in the Islamic State. So we're actually, rather than doing what Obama really wanted to do, which was to bomb Assad into oblivion, he is now bombing Assad's opponents into oblivion, or at least attempting to do so. It's just amazing that we can be played so easily as a country, that we would use our military to try to dethrone Assad, and then to turn around to use our military to attack those who are his most effective enemies. It's stunning that a country that pretends to be peacemakers, that pretends to be enlightened, caring people, can be hoodwinked into doing something that ridiculous. Anyway, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said that the rebels fired hundreds of rockets and shells into at least seven government-held areas late on Thursday. By Friday morning, they had made small advances the monitoring group said. The Syrian state news agency, Sana, said that the assault had been repelled and more than 100 terrorists killed. Well, Aleppo, once Syria's commercial and industrial hub, has been divided roughly in half between the government-held territories in the west and the rebel, jihadi-controlled territories in the eastern quarters for almost 3 years. But in this going back in between, this civil war, 60% of the city is destroyed.